Hello, this is Patrick from the Fundamental Principle. We're going to do another section. I think we're a little under halfway through chapter 4 here. We're going to open with a prayer like usual and get back into it. In the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, soul of Christ, sanctify us. Body of Christ, save us. Blood of Christ, inebriate us. Water from Christ's side, wash us. Passion of Christ, strengthen us. O good Jesus, hear us. Within thy wounds, hide us. Suffer us not to be separated from thee. Amen. Toward a full human development, it is necessary, therefore, to review the very concept of development, sparing it from the discussion of technocrats wherein it has been locked, the reinserting into a debate about how the kind of society that we want. The economic system is not just mechanical and is never neutral. By encouraging men to adopt such behavior is to maximize their interest. It has a strong influence on the face and the soul of our country. The economic question is first and foremost moral and political. Pope Paul VI proclaims that, quote, to say development, unquote, is in effect worry about social progress, such as an economic growth. So we must build an integral human development, unquote, promote the family as the base of society, enhance the cultural of, quote, civilization as received by ancestors, unquote, and reignite legitimate professional organizations into the center of decisions. Instead of the political parties, which are factors of division, the responsibility of these organizations is a great one, given the educational task that they can and must at the same time perform. Well organized and well recognized, these intermediary bodies between the individual and the state, neutral counter powers, are permitted incentives to stay in the country. Corporate social order, an antidote to emigration. Involved professional organization and political decisions was the aim to reform project of the Senate presented by the Aldi in 1969 among 320 senators. 146 would be elected by organizations present in social and cultural economic activities in the country. Employees, farmers, professions, families, etc. It is not enough, but the idea was good. The idea had already been put forth in the Abbott Prix, a candidate for the popular Republican movement for the legislator, alongside the House of Representatives. Abbott Prix proposed the creation of another representative chamber elected by trade unions, family associations, and local communities, unquote, which would elect the head of state with a legislator. Abbott Prix was also a supporter of the family vote. These innovations come from an observation made by José Antonio Rivera, a martyr of the Spanish Falifax. Quote, no one is ever born into a political party. On contrary, we are all born members of a family. We are all residents of a community, and we make a living by some work. Unquote. The observation applies to all nations. No one is born in isolation. We all have a history, such as an ambition assumes a total overhaul of trade unionism to make it truly representative of all the players in the economy, as well as the purification of state power, the idea that no honest liberal could deny. Basically, DeRiva is proclaiming the futility of a class struggle whose destructive conflict has been transposed to public life by the chamber of political parties, hence a necessary change of regime. The order is found on the principle of subsidiary, the heart of the church's social doctrine. Each level of society must assume the largest number of tasks that is it is possible to accomplish without the help of superior levels. Thus revealed parasitic functions encumbering its operations, the central Power can move officially, mediate social relations, and intervene only as last resort. The principle of subsidiary is both an effective and its application and fair is its principle. A homeland is a social body whose unity depends strictly upon the autonomy of each of its members, diversity and unity. Created after the fall of the Roman Empire, medieval guilds were practical implementations of this philosophy, having arisen from necessity in a Europe confused by imperial collapse and Germanic invasions. The guilds were consolidated by custom outside of any invasion by the state, regent, or nobility. There were bodies free of all regulation up to the end of the 15th century, and their longevity throughout the ancient Rome attests to their relevance. The guild brought together all of the actors in a trade, apprentices, journeymen, and masters. There were communities of similarity through work. Thanks to them, the worker was the owner of his own tool and his trade. In effect, the guild itself enacted the rules for carrying out its activity. The choice of raw materials, conditions for manufacture, repression of frauds, the advertising steering customers away from others was very stigmatized. Honor in the trade was a key value. Love for work, well done, and scrupulous respect of know-how were at the heart of the guild's economy. The medieval proverb says, quote, "Any son of a shoemaker is a born prince," unquote. Can you imagine the benefits of having a state of mind on the position by resonating their pride of to the youth of all continents, thus vacating them against the jealousy of Western bling-bling? The sensibility of the guild would be a powerful antidote against migratory exile. I mean, I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, he's right to a degree that, like, we need to have pride in our work and love for our family and history, but I think the non-white world doesn't care, finds more pride in objects and materialism than they ever do work. I don't know if this seems to be more of a long-standing part of their races than actual finding nobility in a trade. Guilds were also circles of life with their specific rhythm, particular devotions, and above all, reinsurance systems, ensuring the health of the members, including the old and disabled, the livelihood of the poor, educated to orphans, and ensuring all well, that women and children did not have to work outside the home, etc. You know, women, you know, definitely constantly worked, just making clothes. Like, if you ever go to a reenactment, either you can do, what is it called? Like, early America reenactments, or if you can find a medieval reenactment, you can find, like, I've gone to a couple in Europe, handmade clothes with these, like, looms or spinning machines. Like, that was a whole day process. Like, you could spend hours and hours and weeks on making a shirt or a new belt or spinning yarn. It was quite the undertaking for women to do. So it's to say that, like, the medieval peasant did not work, or the worked less, I don't know how much I believe that, just with the process of, you know, making raw materials into something productive, like a shirt. Just a regular shirt could take 10 hours, or a belt could take, you know, I've seen, you know, 90 minutes, so it definitely really depends. Guilds were also circles of life with a specific rhythm, particular devotions. Okay, I read that. Continuing, the guild ensured the well-being of its members without skimping on quality work, synthesizing the aspirations of freedom and security. It neither barren statism nor predatory liberalism, but rather solitary of the community. As Abbot Pre said in his candidacy announcements, quote, "We do not want the anarchic liberty which surrenders the weak to the strong, nor the communist collectivization which kills all joy and innovation, but rather the liberation for all, for a just economic and social organization, protecting the rights of each person," unquote. This same Abbot Pre required a, quote, closely filtered immigration, unquote, and the expulsion of all undesirable immigrants. The guild system derives back from the dependence generated by development aid and liberal capitalism that destroyed local identities in name of the industrial growth. For the one promotes wanting, for one promotes weeding around for handouts, making populations dependent on foreign aid, and the other encourages self-contempt by intimidating the West. In both cases, it discourages populations from finding themselves and necessary strength for their awakening. And dehumanizing these peoples through statism or liberalism, they create the condition for the migratory exile. We cannot remake history. The African and Asian societies are not made up of the same stuff as the European neighbors, but we have every reason to be freely inspired by a system that, according to history, Henri Pinere was, quote, a social ordering that was more complete than any other time, including ours, unquote. This is not a question of forcing the social organization of medieval Europe into cities into Africa or Asia cities in the 21st century, but to draw from the spirit of the guilds, then what can be fitted into a reality of Africa and Asia today, so that these countries might develop according to their own rhythm and genius. Global free trade against nature. Founded on the principle of subsidiary, a guild-like social order is localist by nature, since it organizes life in common from ground up through the self-sufficiency of the core communities. This local self-sufficiency is the key to maintaining populations on their land. As Pope Paul VI represented integral human development, the question of localism has not yet come up because countries had not yet abandoned sovereignty in favor of a faceless globalization. But in our day, truly Catholic social thinking cannot ignore this divisive issue. It is not free exchange that will discourage immigration, but rather the certainty of being able to live by one's production or that of one's neighbor. In a word, autonomy, another word for rootedness. This is why third world countries must free themselves from the imperatives of production system that leans heavily towards exports, like the peasant slave of Brazil, China, Senegal, who produce agro-fuels for the 4x4s in San Francisco, instead of tilling the earth to feed their families. Monopopulations of the soil by major commercial groups producing monocultures for exports, like soy and cane sugar in Latin America for the production of ethanol, or eucalyptus trees in countries of southern Africa, production of paper, driven down small farms that help sustain entire regions. This is a real economy of pillage. The international imperialism of money, unquote, denounced by Pope Paul this Pius VI, or Pope Pius XI, sorry. We will not actually stop the migrant hurricane without calling free trade into question and affect global independent subjects, people to foreign demand in order to satisfy their vital needs. It is a system against nature that, let alone the lets the fox into the hen house. Here's how St. Thomas Aquinas writes: a city that needs a multitude of goods to survive must necessarily maintain contact with foreign social life. It disrupts, therefore, it is preferable to a city for a city to receive its food from its own territory than it is fully exploited for trading, unquote. Rootedness through localism. Localism is not the prohibition of international commerce, which has always existed. International trade was generally reserved for exotic goods in earlier times, which required a period of getting used to before being cultivated in our latitudes, like tomatoes, chocolates, or tobacco. For the rest of the textile tools, meats, basic fruits, and vegetables that was produced locally, France, the fact remained largely agriculture up until the middle of the 19th century, even up until the advent of consumer societies, mega farms in the 1960s. The entire world lucrative. Most people are from their own land, even them by themselves, We're not the ones growing it. Localism is simply a principle of good sense. Making the best use of resources that are directly available to us isn't the original localism parable of the talents, Matthew 25:14-30. More than 90% of local of agricultural obligations in the world are small farms of little more than 5 acres on average, but they represent only a quarter of agricultural land globally. However, they produce nearly 80% of the food in non-industrial societies. These small farms protect the countryside, feed the local economy, villagers that would have died otherwise, thus safeguarding social cohesion and slowing down depopulation from the countryside. From Indonesia to Honduras, in their countries with a little rule of law due to total corrupt political power, multinational companies employed mercenaries to assassinate small farms who do not want to surrender their land, and for good reason, because small farms are much more productive than their industrial colleagues, which are largely dependent on gargantuan irrigation systems, chemical fertilizers, toxic pesticides. But small farms are not profitable according to the logic of the globalized economy. Only a few dozen peasant feeding their families does not mean much in terms of GDP as compared to a large palm oil operation whose production can be sold throughout the world. The global consumer society that it, with its large land holdings and cheap abundance, has engineered the death of these small farmers. Like the Industrial Revolution brought the death of our own in Europe in the 19th century. The Association Grain, which explains that most of the families who depend on the small farm need some for their household members to work off the farm in order to be able to continue to occupy the land. This implies massive migration, leading to the permanent insecurity for those who leave and those who remain. It is not some left-wing globalists who are inciting migratory flows. It's not even the no-border types who help illegal immigrants cross the borders. It's the global industrial capitalism. The sole alternative to global uprooting is localism. We don't need to make everyone in the world a farmer, but we do need to allow people to have sovereignty, which is also economic and political sovereignty, in order that we must give them back their dignity. This is the best antidote to uprooting. Christianity is localism. In preventing small farms over large industrial operations, localism encourages small land holdings. In this, it is a factor of peace and social harmony. It is remarkably easy. The outline of Sassanidy, the Catholic writer G.K. Chesterton praises this kind of property, a candle of prosperous economy above all creative property. All throughout Europe, the peasant has invented trades and has made embroidery that have been rediscovered with delight by artists while they have been long neglected by aristocrats. Have you seen peasant dancers? They represent those of kings and queens. It is this satisfaction of creative instinct that belongs to every individual that gives the peasantry on the whole a powerful conservative character. A multitude of men stand on their feet because they stand on their own land. This reflection is absolutely crucial. Creativity does not belong to the nomadic man. It cannot hatch in a relativistic and libertarian time period. Creativity is the privilege of the rooted sedentary culture, which sees itself as a link in a very ancient tradition. There where things do not change, man is all the more inclined to forge works. This time wishes to conserve in order to pass them down to our descendants. It is in periods of stability and social order that one creates the most, not in troubled times where everything is in question and permanent insecurity with fear of the future discovers any innovation, including starting a family. In the moments of history where man drew his whole existence, material, cultural, and spiritual, from a small geographic area, there is where he was the most creative. Is this not a formidable lesson for the people of the third world, tempted to throw themselves into the casino economy of globalism? On the contrary, learning from the European Middle Ages, they will see that the true development is in returning to one's own, rather than it is the dissolution of one's identity in favor of cheap world culture. It is being rooted rather than being among the scattered migrants. In their collective book, Le Moron Age Pure Ferret, Regina Pond and Jean Gimbel and Raymond Delouche have shown that the salvation of the third world is not to be found in industrialization, but the autonomy which was acquired by Europe during the Middle Ages. They write, quote, "The 2 million villages of the third world do not have the technological knowledge that it, in particular, the mechanics of the European village of the 12th and 13th centuries. They're not 200 years behind Europe, but rather 800 years behind," unquote. I mean, that's incredibly racist to say, but I think it's reality that we have to engage with, that it's just these people can't be like us for whatever reason. Not the 18th century England that Africa or Asia must imitate, but medieval Europe, breaking with liberalism, their era of Protestant heresy, and the anti-Catholic Enlightenment Europe, the eldest daughter of the church in the world, must be the flagship of integral human development, a development founded on rootedness, prosperity created, local solidarity. To summarize, rootedness, property creative, property creativity, and local solidarity. To summarize, the firmness in the fight against illegal immigration, the promotion of rootedness in countries of immigration are two complementary aspects of the same policy. Let us be done with the sterile and binary versions. Let us walk on our own two legs. The reality of assimilation. A time bomb. The policy of promoting rootedness would be insufficient if it only focused on candidates for immigration. Those who have not left their country to come to Europe, they need for roots also greatly affects a large number of descendants of non-European immigrants already in Europe. Rooted, frustrated, unrooted, uprooted, frustrated and hateful for many, rendered schizophrenic by Western liberties, unattainable rigor of Islam, they are monstrous children of a multiculturalist utopia. Again, to tackle the cause is not enough to eliminate the consequences. The real problem in those who are already here, who always had French citizenship and nevertheless do not wish to be French. It is always useful to look at the number. There are in France in between 13 and 14 million people of foreign origin, according to Jean-Paul Gourvitch, or about 20% of the population, which is large majority are Africans, North and South Sahara, North and Sub-Sahara, and Turks. Identitarian awakening among the immigrants. What do we do? First off, we must recognize the identitarian trending in a very strong among the descendants of immigrants. T-shirts proudly proclaiming the independence of North African countries, slowly practicing a Ramadan country claimed, so many strong science manifest at a young age, a total rejection of France and desire to reconnect with their roots. In fact, the immigrant descendants compared to their forefathers manifest more violently this rejection of France, whereas in theory they should be, quote, more French, unquote, than their grandparents. Yeah, E. Michael Jones, blown away. This is, I mean, they just don't have a willingness to assimilate. I mean, maybe I'm strawmanning Dr. Jones, but it's, you know, he might say, like, well, you have to force their conversion. I don't think you can force conversion. I don't want to strawman Dr. Jones. We'll be, you know, at this point, there should be an episode released. Yeah, we will, I think, going back into listening to our conversation with American Reform, with Dr. Jones and the idea of the Christian Church of Race would probably be beneficial. The fact that immigrant descendants compared to their forefathers manifest more violently this rejection of France, whereas in the theory they should be more French. Then their grandparents is an indisputable sign of the identitary awakening and don't believe that things were necessarily better before. Since the 1960s, writes reporter Alan Chalvarez, quote, Muslims who lived in the migrant worker housing of San Carota claimed places of prayer and suppressed the sale of alcohol in their units, unquote. The largest generation of Africans living in France are the ones most in search of identity. It is a predictable outcome raised on hatred of colonizers and collaborators. The Africans of this country have known no other history of France. And then there's the damage done by SOS, Racine, and other subsidiary splinter groups, which have largely spread the virus of victimhood and revenge, Arab African problem, and the Asian migration. The Republic has done nothing to assimilate these migrants, but it is really the only explanation for the anti-French fury of young Africans, Vietnamese, Cambodians, Italians, Portuguese, and Poles don't burn cars, ambush firefighters in Lali Bukrain, their ethnic origins. I don't know, depending on the Italian, I think they can. Well, at least, I don't know. Maybe it's just the New Jersey Italians, a little different than everybody else. It's a little joke. However, let us not idealize Asians in France, for their immigration does not have such a positive record here. Look at the takeover of large numbers of old bistros and small shops in Paris by the Chinese. This concern about 50% of the tobacco shops. Such a community takeover of a sector is an emblematic of our French way of life, is not accepted. But even in this phenomenon of worrisome, well-thought-out regulatory measures and the end to the tax racket that affects small merchants can easily bring this to an end. Asian immigrants, Chinese in particular, is not a problem of civilization. The Asian presence in France does not threaten the peace and survival of our country. On the other hand, there is an Arab and African problem in France, and no one can deny that. In the great assimilation policy, the solution to the unrootedness of these paper citizens, some argue with Jean-François Sherman, a teacher at the high school in Wayne suburb, that, quote, it is necessary to transmit to them, to those who, above all, are still impressionable, a love for France. But who can we achieve that if ourselves are ashamed to be French, unquote. Jean-François Kerman is right about one thing. You don't assimilate to nothing. That is the kind of talk, and is a bit perverse. It leads quickly to the idea that the fundamental problems here come from our country, from the French themselves, because immigrants are always victims of history, and we always are the guilty ones. Finally, whether it comes from leftist talk of repentance, or from the assimilist talk of a center element on the right, which suffers from paternalism towards Africans, it is always the fault of whites who are generally doing wrong. Yeah, that's, you know, it goes back to like the long-standing conversation of like, who are we centering? Are we still centering non-whites? Are we? And it's like, oh, what is good for non-white? I don't care. Like, they're not my people. They're not my problem. I'm not, you know, it's not our duty to look over. You know, Atlas should shrug his shoulders when it comes to the white man's burden, is what I'm saying. Basically, the street scum rape French women in the basements of their enclaves. It's because they've never talked to them about the baptism of Clovis, the king of the Franks. In the very heart of the national right-wing politics, some really think that our decadence is the primary reason for the terrorist attacks have happened in France over the last few years, nearly 300 dead. If they attack us, it's because we have legalized gay marriage and have developed gender theory in schools. I mean, I think that's some of that's true. Like, I don't think you wouldn't have immigrants and gender theory. I mean, I think there's one relates to the other. I don't know if it's complete one for one. Or to put, in other words, in the other way around, quote, if they don't like us, it's because we've become decadent and they're completely rejecting our general values, so we search for identity more to their tastes, and ISIS gives that to them, unquote. Or they search for identity and more to their tastes, and ISIS gives that to them. Maybe these brilliant experts should ask themselves why Islam, from Muhammad to ISIS, has never stopped sending its faithful to attack France and Europe, even when we're Christendom and had Kingdom of France, had Saint Louis at its head. Jean Louis Carmen didn't necessarily say these things, it's true, but between his speech and that of a supporter of reconciliation with Muslims in the name of the pseudo-convergence of traditional values against a common enemy, maybe the Atheist Republic or Zionists, there are only a difference of degree, not of kind. This sort of tortured thinking shows the influence of Marxist mentality on the right-wing thinking, a hysterical conspiracy theory. Every ethnic tension, even conflict between the two populations, is only the fruit of political manipulation, a strategy of division organized by the dominant over the dominated of all organs. It is not the inevitable consequence observed 1,000 times in history of the coexistence on the same territory of human groups. They're culturally opposed. The opposition of it is negatory, the negation of reality, an ideological flight from a fear of naming the enemy, whereas he has not hesitated a second in defining us as such. These cultural Marxists rather live in an intellectual software virus of the right through the intellectual Marxist reflexes. Behind the faded intellectualism, a true plague on French political thought, that is the hatred of self. By trying to avoid a cowardly retreat, these people have chosen to piss themselves in politics as in religion over the scrupulous who have always proclaimed their guilt in the first place. Their guilt in the first of all full of pride, for it is always easier to declare oneself at fault. In any attempt to persuade oneself these things depended on one's personal rather than to admit that one is important to the face of certain natural laws of life. Furthermore, the analysis of Jean-Francois Kerman is a little simplistic on the question of assimilation, because in practice assimilation is a complex process, for it has to be realized several important conditions need to be come together. Let us take a moment to define it. Do not confuse integration and assimilation. Integration in the economic interest of an individual. This individual has a job, pays taxes, respects the law, but lives as if he were in a homeland. Imperial to French culture. And one day we find his face on the evening news with the police looking for him, like Salah Adid Islam or Fahd Muhammad Abaga. The perpetrators of the attacks on November 13, 2015 in Paris. Conversely, assimilation assumes that the immigrant divests himself of his culture, embraces that of the host country in all its aspects, language, food, culture, basic knowledge of national history, etc. Assimilation is generally accompanied by the second generation, like the children of the Poles, Italians, Russian immigrants, who often don't even know the language of their parents and bear the French first name, like King Philip of France, son of the Ukrainian Princess Anne de Kiev, or the poet Guillaume Apollinaire, the novelist Emile Zola, the singer Edith Piaf, the actor Jean-Paul Belmondo, or even Serge Gainsbourg. The French melting pot is European. Immigrants who were Europeans and culturally Christians, unconscious heirs of the common civilization, have no problem becoming French for the good reason that they were already cousins by blood. Culture and religion let us define the definition of French, according to Charles de Gaulle. Quote, a person of what the right race, of Greek and Latin culture, and of Christian religion, unquote. We could just say as much for a Spaniard, a Pole, an Italian, a Romanian. As Eric Zemmour says, quote, the French is not a Europe, she is Europe, unquote. Whether it to be the terms of climate, botany, linguistics, history, France, at one continental Atlantic and Mediterranean is certainly the fruit of crossbreeding and European crossbreeding. But European crossbreeding. While people bring up the French quote-unquote melting pot, the typical French recipe for assimilation, it should be still remembered that this concern a large kinship rather than a collection of concrete political measures. There has never been an assimilation policy. Assimilation is a spontaneous historical phenomena where the indigenous people and the immigrant resemble one another sufficiently to coexist without hindrance. Human societies absorb only inputs that are not contrary to their own characteristics. The second you could have to force things, then the marriage is not possible. No European immigrant on his arrival in France is obligated to take a history course, cooking lessons, or a language course. None of them has to sign a contract about national identity, but living among the French, even if living together, has not always been easy. At first, assimilation takes place smoothly enough and frequently that some parish or pub of the same work or simply living next door. But assimilation is not a sociocultural phenomena. The world has its history and its political idea embodied by men, carried by speech and sanctuary of history. Assimilation, a progressive idea born in the French Revolution. The benefits of assimilation of non-Europeans as a resurgence of the myth of the noble savage. In the 18th century, against the background of explorers' accounts, the image of the noble savage is an idealized of the primitive man living in harmony with nature. I low-key, I don't know how much I put stock in that. Some of it makes sense to me that the idea of the noble savage is a big boom of why Ted Kaczynski was so popular. That we too have something to go back to. I mean, sure, there was that natural tie into the land and wanting to be outside of such a terrible woke time period. I think that's part of it, but I think there's also like the there's a was an interior need to be savage. That way, the white people would finally have an excuse to be savage. The philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau contributed much to the forming of this idea, of this legend. Quote, the man is naturally a good being and loving justice and order. That is completely contrary to the Catholic faith, that we have to force ourselves to be good and that sin is in our natural state. For the first moments of nature are always right, unquote. Like the primitive people of yesterday, there are the argument, so the argument goes, the immigrant of today will necessarily be docile and malleable, naturally predisposed to loving France. We need only to create the appropriate institutions to awaken his feelings already present in him. But since the fall of Adam and Eve, which deprived man of the graces of the original holiness, we know that it is easier to give in to the evil than it is to do good. Lacking good Christian sense, the assimilist views are errors through utopianism. It is not a coincidence that assimilation consciously borrow from Rousseau as a part of his analysis. Assimilationists unconsciously borrow from Rousseau a part of his analysis. As a man of the Enlightenment, Rousseau was the inspiration of the French Revolution. However, the political concept of assimilation is deeply derived from the Revolution before being used to justify organization of the colonial territories of the French departments. Arthur Grault, a lawyer specializing in colonial law, says assimilation should be thought of as a direct heir of the French Revolution because the Constitution of the year 1795 declared that the colonies were an integral part of the Republic. Now, no, the policy of assimilation wound up the drama of the war in Algeria, the massacres of the European, in the forced exile of the Pettus Norris, the born of the French Revolution, assimilation died, and decolonization. So why bother trying to redo with the same population which had already failed in the time of the colonies, knowing that unlike today, the French state had those times actual power and domination of the industrious Muslim completely. The first supporters of the assimilation were passionate Republicans, like historian Jules Michelet, who was devoted to the Republic and decided to cut the dedicated to the call to progress. Wherever our doubts may be, our uncertainties in the times of transition, let us firmly believe progress, science, and liberty. If Michelet fiercely defended universal assimilation, which France tends towards, it is because his vision of history is fully impregnated with globalist pride. Quote, he who wants invariably to make the world in his own image will eventually achieve it, unquote. Regrettably, in desperation of peoples, he called for the going beyond, quote, a society limited by homeland, unquote, in order to build the, quote, republic of the world, unquote, because it denies the strength of the rooted achievements and the permanence of identities. Assimilationism is the first step towards globalism. Political concept of assimilation, not to be confused with assimilation as a very real phenomena, from Blanche de Castey to Louis de Funes. It is the cornerstone of the Republic Universalism. It is the ideology of human rights, which justifies the extermination of the Vendéens, Corrosion, and the villains with the quote-unquote impure blood, but justifies welcoming all the rapists of the world. As possible, assimilation manifests itself automatically. To advocate for policy of assimilation is already to admit failure. You do not manufacture Frenchmen by regulatory degrees. Men are not a clay to be molded or objects that can be moved about as once he fits. Men are beings of flesh and spirit, bearers of history and memory of their own. King Hassel II of Morocco died in 1999. Talk about this with Philip de Villiers and several interviews with the French media when the founder of Puy du Fou asked him about his possibility of assimilating Moroccans. Quote, even when they would like to, they will not be able to. Or they will be bad Frenchmen. Moroccans will forever remain Moroccan and Muslim. Do not ask us to lose our identity. You will dissolve your own. Policy of assimilation would be totalitarian. Implementing such an assimilation policy would necessarily be cohesive, if not brutal. To carry out assimilation policy, it would necessarily to spread the newly arrived immigrants throughout the national territory, impose them upon courses on the French way, life prohibit access to their foreign satellite channels from above, prohibit any name first outside the church, the turtle calendar basically to live in a totalitarian state throughout and behave for is totalitarian policing thought and behavior practically impossible. Moreover, such a state would be ineffective. Such immigrants would have secretly lived out their identity like the Morosos did in a century and a half after the Spanish Reconquista. Now, I could be wrong on this. Now, I vaguely remember the Ottomans doing this to the Mamelukes with their slave soldiers. Give them military rank and duties of honor, and then the Mameluke would be loyal because they didn't want to end up like a slave in the field. And that way it created their own culture of themselves. They gave up their past lives and identities to be this honored warrior of the Ottoman Empire. But obviously that was under coercion. I don't know if white people are capable of such brutality which is, you know, definitely a blessing. But I don't... The European, the white man's idea of, like, recurrent... with slave soldiers, I don't know if really exists to the point where it was like the brutalizing them. Obviously there was dead slaves, but I don't think they were ever forced to fight. It wasn't considered honorable to have slaves fight for free men, to my recollection. Identitary inertia of immigrant communities. We are dealing with people who have a very strong tribal mentality. When they live in France, they maintain, and despite their divisions and Western influence, a heavily communitarian structure. The group before being individuals. Additionally, they are sufficiently numerous in our country that they feel right at home and do not need to live like the French. For this is primary motive that pushes one to want to assimilate to a group, to live well and to live in security. However, their living conditions are often better than those of the impoverished French, for their identitarian well-being is superior to ours, since they can live at home among us without fearing any reprimand. It is this way they feel strong enough to reject the French culture that they deem weak and decadent. Under these conditions, they have absolutely no interest in becoming French. The propaganda of SOS Racine, a company as damnable as they are, even in the failures of city policies, as their judicial educational laxity. They have only played an aggregate role in this, but they certainly did not cause the phenomena. Any foreign group growing faster than the indigenous population winds up imposing their morals on the whole. Just like we see this in the United States, with the undergoing Mexican immigration somewhat less harmful than ours, which is still suffering a cultural transformation where Hispanics are becoming majority. A sufficient number of immigrants is all it takes to generate communitarianism that the assimilationists identify as a result of bad policy management. And with that, we will end this episode. If you are, I'll probably make an announcement on the top of the show next time too, but if you are subscribed to us through the paywall on Substack, or we do have a group chat on Telegram if you're interested, for anybody paying or donating to us. We do have an ability for one-time donations. It really helps a lot. It helps us buy books. I know it helped everybody's assistance with that. I mean, good things are coming. But yeah, if you have any comments, questions, concerns, please email the show at fppodcastcontact@gmail.com. I'll make a mention in the next beginning of next show too. We appreciate all the support.